Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview from peterbcollins.com. This program is supported by subscribers like Teresa Phillips, Stephen Kalupev, Thomas Wilkutz, and Robert Getzlaff. And during the month of April, we're trying to double our number of subscribers. I don't have Ginsu knives, but I've got a great book bonus for new subscribers. The book is Hank Albarelli's landmark investigation of the CIA's secret bioweapons projects, including the dosing of unsuspecting Americans and others with LSD. And the book goes to people who sign up for an annual subscription, people who sign up for a subscription at more than $10 a month. And we've got some books we'll give away in a random drawing to new subscribers who sign up for the basic $5 a month subscription. So do me a favor and spread the word. Tell your friends that April is new member month here at peterbcollins.com. Will we ever see accountability for wrongdoing during the Bush-Cheney era? Well,
good evening.
Let's go way, way back.
At our convention, Miami, FLA.
To the last bad presidency.
A campaign across the USA. Let me make this perfectly clear.
Or shall we just say one of them? Ear.
They said, hey, babe, make a date with the Watergate. My fellow Americans, I said, hey, honey, make a date with the Watergate. And Martha Mitchell says, do.
Elizabeth Holtzman returns to our program today. She was one of the youngest people elected to Congress and served on the House Judiciary Committee during the process that led very close to the impeachment of Richard Nixon in the 1970s. And we connected with her back in about 2005 or 2006. When she first wrote a column for The Nation and then expanded that into a book on the process of impeaching Bush and Cheney. She has not stopped fighting for accountability. She has co-authored a new book called Cheating Justice, subtitled How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law and Plotted to Avoid Prosecution and What We Can Do About It. She co-wrote the book with Cynthia L. Cooper. Elizabeth Holtzman, welcome back to our program.
Thanks. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
Well, it's nice to talk with you, and I really commend you for keeping up this fight for accountability, because when it was more politically popular during the when Bush was really at his low point in popularity, there were many Democrats who called for accountability. But now those who were elected to office have largely gone silent and moved on, and I'm pleased that you're still concerned about accountability, Congresswoman.
Well, maybe it's because I learned about accountability for people in high places during Watergate. We had a president of the United States who was guilty of serious abuses. We had investigations in the Senate. We had a grand jury inquiry. We had prosecutions of his top aides. We had the president named as an unindicted co-conspirator. We had impeachment proceedings that started in the House Judiciary Committee, and actually the committee voted on a bipartisan basis for his impeachment.
That's right.
There were huge reports done on this. The historical record is clear. And perhaps it wasn't perfect, but it was a substantial effort to say to a president of the United States, you can't get away with breaking the law just because you're president. And I thought, and I think many of my colleagues thought, Democrat and Republican, that this would be the last time we ever saw that. But,
yeah.
I mean, during the Bush administration, we saw great great abuses of power, both with regard to the deceptions that led to that drove the country into the Iraq War, with regard to torture and mistreatment of detainees, with regard to wiretapping without a court order. And impeachment was taken off the table. And so when he left office, the question was, okay, is that it? Can a president just blithely engage in abuses? Nothing happens. Is this just the same thing as what happened to the banks? Nothing, economy can be wrecked and there's no accountability. A democracy can be attacked and assaulted and there's no accountability. So,
Ms. Holtzman, I would add to the litany that we have seen the undoing, the unraveling, and even worse in some cases, of the post-Watergate reforms.
Well, I think that's true.
The FISA law in particular.
Well, I would say beyond FISA, you had, first of all, the idea of accountability. That's kind of gone up in smoke. Secondly, campaign finance reform, we tried. I know it was an imperfect job, but that's out the window, basically, with the Supreme Court's decision.
Yes.
We had a special prosecutor law to make sure that there would always be a prosecution if serious charges of criminality existed against people in the highest places of our government. That's out the window. FISA law has been eviscerated. War Crimes Act has been eviscerated. That wasn't in existence then.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think that the legal structure has been watered down, but the good news is that I examined very carefully with my co-author federal criminal code, and we looked at areas in which it was a possibility of accountability, and we found that on the face of it, we lawyers like to call it, or prosecutors like to call it, a prima facie case.
Right.
We think that there's a prima facie case. In other words, on the face of it, it looks as though three federal criminal statutes have been violated by the former president of the United States. And we took a good look at them. We took a good look at the defenses. Obviously, just because there's a prima facie case doesn't mean there ever will be a prosecution, because a real prosecutor, not a book, but a real prosecutor has to take a good hard look at the evidence, has to look at the law, has to look at the possible defenses,
and then make a decision. Don't we also need a review of the evidence since that's been supplied by the prospective defendants in their best-selling books?
Of course. Well, that's part of the record. I mean, part of the point. The three areas are where we found possible criminal violations. One is the statute 371 federal code, which says that it's a crime to conspire to defraud the United States government. By the way, that's a section that was used again to prosecute one of the main Watergate culprits, H.R. Haldeman.
Right.
It was a statute that was used to prosecute the Iran-Contra culprits. And so it's got a long pedigree in prosecuting top-level government officials. We think that's been violated. But with regard to the torture of detainees and with regard to wiretapping without a court order, you have admissions. You don't even have any factual questions. The President of the United States and the Vice President, and with regard to both these areas, have both said they were involved. I mean, President Bush repeatedly in his memos and in public statements and in TV interviews, and Vice President Cheney as well, both acknowledged that they were involved in authorizing and in supporting the waterboarding of detainees. Waterboarding is torture. We've prosecuted as torture, and foreign countries have prosecuted waterboarding as torture. Everybody understands that waterboarding is torture. And the president's argument as to why he could engage in it, remember the name of this book is My Decision Points. Actually, he should have called it My Lawyer's Decision Points, because he said, my lawyer told me I could do it. But we go through a very careful analysis of the legal advice he got, which was manifestly and obviously flawed, fallacious, and not even a serious effort to provide anything except to get out of jail card for the president. So I think that the excuse is not there, and so you have, sadly, the spectacle of three serious statutes: conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government, torturing in violation of the Anti-Torture Act, and violating the FISA Act, all of which are federal crimes, a big deal, and a felony.
And Congresswoman, these are things that I care deeply about, and we cover Guantanamo issues on a regular basis on this program. We have covered the Al-Haramain wiretapping case here in San Francisco that was successful in establishing that individuals had been illegally surveilled and wiretapped by our government. And we've also covered the issues of the conspiracy that you address. And let me ask you to respond to recent developments here. On Sunday, the Independent of London published an interview with Rafid Ahmed Alwan Al-Janabi, better known as Curveball. And Curveball takes responsibility for the lies that he told that were used in part to propel the United States into an invasion of Iraq in 2003. And Curveball is now on record saying that he fabricated the entire thing about the mobile biological weapons laboratories that were used as the alleged evidence when Colin Powell gave his famous inaccurate speech at the United Nations on February 6th of 2003. So let me ask you to take the information from Curveball. It's not under oath, so I won't label it evidence at this point, but it is testimony. And I'd like to ask you what we can do with this. How can we move forward with an investigation into the lies that led to the war in Iraq and hold accountable those who helped propel them?
Well, there are two ways of proceeding. One is to proceed in terms of how prosecutors always proceed. When it looks like the law has been broken, prosecutor starts to investigate, and there's standard procedures for investigating, and then you determine whether a crime has been committed. You present it to a grand jury, and if the grand jury indicts, there you are. You proceed with a trial. Well, that's one way to proceed here, and of course, we don't have a special prosecutor law, so picking a special prosecutor would be something that would require action by an attorney general of the United States, because we're talking about federal statutes, criminal statutes. The second thing that can be done, and they are independent of each other, but both should be done, because the prosecution doesn't necessarily uncover the whole story, or because it may not be relevant at trial. But the whole story is really important with regard to Iraq, because the consequences have been staggering. 4,000 Americans killed, tens of thousands wounded, some for life, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, wounded. Mm-hmm. And the latest figures I saw, we spent $3 trillion on the war, and that the costs still are with us.
Yes.
So if someone deceived us into going to war or lied or violated a criminal statute, we need to know about it. So what can be done is what has happened in Britain. Great Britain convened what I would call a truth commission.
Right.
It's been attacked as being too establishment, but the fact of the matter is that they did a pretty methodical job of going through the evidence bit by bit. They had all the top officials of the government come down and testify. It turned out that the Attorney General had given an opinion to Blair that the war was illegal, and then at the last minute changed his mind, but Blair never made that public to the people of Great Britain or to the rest of his cabinet. So there's some important evidence that's come out from that. They haven't written their final report, but if Great Britain could do a full and thorough examination of the events that led to the Iraq War, why couldn't we? And indeed, Holland did the same thing. They appointed a very highly respected former judge of the Supreme Court who did an examination of the lead-up to Holland's involvement in the war, and they found the same kind of deceptions of the Dutch Parliament as was took place in Britain, as took place in the United States, and of the Dutch people. And they found that Supreme Court judge, a former Supreme Court judge, found that the Iraq War was illegal under international law. Mm-hmm. That's the first such finding. Well, why can Holland do it, and why can Britain do it, and why can't we do it? Are we so incapable? Are we less capable than those countries of looking and finding out the truth? I don't think so. And if you want to get to the issue of torture, it's now reported that yes, Poland has apparently indicted the chief of former chief of intelligence in Poland. Those at least newspaper reports suggest that. because of his cooperation with the CIA in connection with a secret prison
right.
in Poland, mm-hmm. where waterboarding took place in violation of Polish law as well as international law. If the Poles can prosecute criminal conduct, we turn our face away from it. What kind of nation are we becoming? What's really serious here is that if a president can say that as president he's above the law, then where do we go as a country?
And Congresswoman,
then what can't he do? So Bush this time did X and Y, drove us into a war,
mm-hmm.
Tortured abroad, engaged in wiretapping in violation and apparent violation of the law. Well, what will the next president do? Will the torture be of people in the United States? Will they be of people who disagree with the president's policies? Will they be of people of the opposing party? This is the road, the terrible road that we go down when we have a president who may have violated the law and nothing is done. We can't just ignore it, because this message to future presidents is that you can violate the law. You pick whatever law you want to violate, and nothing will happen to you. Well, we can't. If we're a country of laws, if we're a democracy, there can't be a situation where we create an exemption for president, just as we can't create an exemption for the rich and the powerful, even if they run banks.
And Congresswoman, you're actually paraphrasing some of what you wrote in the introduction to the book, and let me quote, "Without strong action holding them responsible, the precedent of a runaway, lawless administration will continue to haunt us. Have we celebrated 220 years of our Constitution to reach a point where, like a banana republic, our highest elected leaders can engage in crimes of illegal surveillance, lying to take the nation into war, torture, disappearance, and degradation with impunity? Let's hope not. Failing to hold the most powerful among us accountable is the sign of a democracy that is losing its way." And Congresswoman, I think you know that I embrace your book, and I really appreciate the brief that you have laid out. The one thing that's missing here, though, is any criticism of Barack Obama and his Attorney General Eric Holder for their fatuous position of looking forward, not backward. That's not an option. That's not something that is just up to them to decide. I believe that you have presented a prima facie case, and that they are duty-bound to follow the law, to launch investigations, not a political witch hunt, but honest investigations to identify who may have broken the law and then hold them accountable. So tell me what your thoughts are about the Obama administration and why in your book you're somewhat circumspect about pressing this administration for the accountability that you so eloquently call for.
Well, first of all, the book was to establish the fact, one, the need for accountability, and two, to lay out the case for accountability, which hadn't been done, and as far as I can tell, and still hasn't been done by anybody else. And I think it's really important to get the factual information about what laws are applicable, what laws appear to have been broken, what the statutes of limitation are, out so that the public has the information at hand. With respect, this is a book about holding presidents criminally accountable or accountable for violation of criminal laws. And so it seems to me incredibly important to get that factual information together. Now, ultimately, the public is going to make a decision about how to proceed with this personally. And we just stopped when we started this book. It was still early in the Obama administration. It wasn't clear what was going to happen. So we just focused on setting out the case against Bush and Cheney, and that was a huge job, and it took a long time to do it. But I can say, outside of the context of the book, I was a former prosecutor in Brooklyn called Kings County,
right.
which is taken by itself as one of the largest cities in the United States. I mean, we had thousands and thousands of murders, rapes, robberies, burglaries, just to talk about the most serious crimes. And if I had said to the people living in Brooklyn, hey, wait a minute, we're just going to look forward, not backward.
Right.
I mean, I would have been run out of office, because nobody believes that you can ever look forward without looking backward. You
cannot
move forward and say, oh, well, we're going to forget about all these crimes that were committed.
Right.
Because if you don't prosecute them, then what's the message? It means it sends several messages if you don't prosecute the crimes. It means that the actions are trivial and unimportant, that you don't care about it, and that you don't want to stop people from doing it in the future. If mm-hmm. you don't prosecute these crimes, you're just sending a terrible signal that the actions are trivial, that the misdeeds are not really important, and that you don't care what happens in the future. You cannot look forward without looking backwards.
We fully agree, Congresswoman. My problem is that Obama and Holder are, in my view, and you're the lawyer here, but in my view, they've become accessories after the fact, or they're involved in an obstruction of justice, and the Congress is failing in its oversight role. The courts do not challenge the expanded assertions of executive authority, and Obama has used the state secrets privilege and pressure on Britain and many other tools to prevent honest investigations into the recent past. And this is a source of great frustration for me, as we saw, let's just take, for example, the Jeppesen case and Binyan Mohammed. We have evidence on the record of the rendition flights and that Jeppesen of San Jose was one of the torture taxi vendors to the government. And yet the courts accepted the argument from the Obama administration that these are all secret and therefore the case cannot proceed at any level on any of the significant issues, even when you protect sources and methods. And I just find this maddening, and I can't let Obama and Holder off the hook for these very intentional acts. These are not passive acts. These are orchestrated efforts to prevent any of that information from coming out and being used for accountability.
Look, presidents like power. I think that that's a fair statement. And that's one of the reasons that I co-authored the bill with then Peter Rodino, who was the famed chair of the House Judiciary Committee and won national respect for his work in that capacity. We passed a special prosecutor bill to take it out of the political process to start investigations of high-level government officials, including presidents. Why did we do that? Because we saw what happened in Watergate. It was just by chance that we got a special prosecutor appointed, Archibald Cox, which set everything in motion. We can't operate on a basis of chance. We can't operate on a basis of wishful thinking. We can't operate on a hope that a president will give up his power. We can't operate that way. We have to have laws and institutions that create effective checks. And, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, that's what you have to be looking at. How do you get an effective check, a checks and balance system? And there is none with regard to the issue of prosecution. Now, with regard to the issue of And so I think you need to have a new special prosecutor law. Mm-hmm. The statute of limitations with regard to torture does not, in my opinion, run out until Bush and Cheney die. There's no statute of limitations with regard to torture, with regard to waterboarding, in my opinion. So I think the incredibly important thing to do is to get the law changed on special prosecutors so that there will be a special prosecutor appointed. Hopefully we can eliminate some of the problems that gave rise to that monstrosity of Kenneth Starr's investigation, which was highly partisan and not fair.
Indeed.
And not professional, in my opinion. But if we can fine-tune the special prosecutor law and reenact it, then that issue is taken out of the hands of any particular president as to whether or not to have a professional prosecution, a professional investigation. I mean, we had a very professional investigation by Patrick Fitzgerald. I have no idea what his politics are, but he did an extremely professional investigation. The country managed to withstand that, and nobody criticized him quality of his work.
Well, wait a minute. I don't agree with that. I don't agree that the Valerie Plame investigation was fair or complete, and I believe that Patrick Fitzgerald was highly partisan in limiting the scope of the investigation to Scooter Libby. And he should have indicted Karl Rove. It appears that there actually was an indictment that somehow was suppressed. And I don't think that that was any kind of a good example of an independent counsel.
Well, I disagree about that. I think he said that his investigation was obstructed, and I think he said that very clearly. But I don't think that, in my view, I think he did a professional job. Could someone have done a better job? Maybe. But I don't think that, I'm not prepared to fault him. But what I am prepared to say is, without a special prosecutor law, which triggers a special prosecutor when there are serious allegations of criminal misconduct by a president or vice president or top cabinet members, we may not likely ever have, no matter what the circumstances are, serious investigations of presidential misconduct, because it looks as though no president wants to examine himself, or certainly not, and presidents don't like to examine their predecessors because maybe that'll cast a bad light on them. This should not be a political decision whether or not to prosecute. This should be a professional prosecution decision. The other thing, though, I want to get off the issue of prosecution for one second, and that is truth commission. That does not have to be set up by the president. Congress can pass legislation calling for that. The president could set it up, I believe, by executive order. It's possible. So I think that we could have a truth commission if we wanted it, and not only about the run-up to the war in Iraq. All the facts are not out with regard to torture. All the facts are not out with regard to wiretapping. In fact, even now, and with regard to the new wiretapping law, members of the Senate are having trouble finding out what's going on. So,
well, Congresswoman, I generally support your point, and a truth commission would be better than nothing. But the experience of the 9/11 commission was a group of insiders who were protecting, not investigating. And even Kane and Hamilton went public after they published their best-selling report and complained about how they had been misled. They were fed information based on torture. They were not permitted to really take the investigation anywhere it wanted to go.
You know something? They themselves allowed the president to testify holding the hand of Dick Cheney in private. That's not what happened in England. What happened in England is they had Tony Blair come there. He wasn't allowed to hold anybody's hand. He had to sit there all by himself, and he had to answer questions in public. And that's what should have been done, too, with respect to President Bush and Vice President Cheney.
But the fact is
it's not too late. And we still, just because it can't be perfect, it's something is better than nothing, and a process that at least exemplifies the goal of accountability is something that we need, instead of, oh, let's just bygones be bygones, because bygones will not be bygones, and we will be haunted in our future by the failure to hold presidents accountable for criminal conduct and other abuses.
Congresswoman, in your book, Cheating Justice, you not only talk about restoring a special prosecutor of some sort, you talk about the need to restore the War Crimes Act, to reclaim protections against unchecked surveillance, the Patriot Act, and its companion legislation. But the most important piece to me is your call for reform of the state secrets privilege. And I have a colleague who I have become very close to in the last few years, named Sybil Edmonds. And I don't know if you know about her case. She was fired from the FBI for properly reporting wrongdoing in the translations department. And they retaliated against her, treating her like she was a criminal or a treasonous spy who had turned on the United States. In fact, she was trying to expose an agent for Turkey who had been planted in the translations department. And this was known to her higher-ups at the agency. And when she did the proper thing and honored her the instructions that came with her security clearance, John Ashcroft placed a state secrets gag order on her. And she became subject to more gag orders than any human being in recent history. She is in the process. Her new book will be out in May, and I've had a chance to read it. It's called Classified Woman. And she really, I think, exemplifies what the state secrets privilege has been used for, not to prevent the disclosure of important state information, but to retaliate against people who stood up to those who were in power as the power shifted and a clear police state at least the outlines of it, have arisen in recent years.
Well, I think the real danger of the State Secrets Act is that it has become a shield to cover governmental misconduct and governmental actions, disclosure of which would be embarrassing. I mean, I had top security clearance, and I served on a commission that was responsible for declassifying millions of pages of government documents. Basically, we found that there was huge overclassification, and in 1973, together with Senator Sam Ervin, I passed a bill that was designed to prevent a State Secrets Act from being adopted by the courts. And what we said at that time was that we wanted the courts to examine, whenever such a privilege was being asserted, to use reason and common sense and experience. Instead, the courts have more or less collapsed in the face of executive invocation of state secrets and of the privilege of state secrets, and that shouldn't be the case. Courts have to exercise a little bit of skepticism. They have to take a good hard look at the claims of the administration, whatever administration is, because administrations love secrets, and secrets sometimes are anathema in a democracy. Sure, there are important secrets that have to be kept, but much of the stuff that's secret, in my experience, is not necessarily isn't necessary to be classified, and the information could come out. And you know, there's a kind of balancing act here, and I think the courts have just caved and given a knee-jerk reaction to the executive. That's not what Congress intended. When we passed that law, we did not intend the courts to cave to the executive. We expected each one of those courts to stand up and seriously take a look at what the claim was of state secrets, and if it wasn't really a valid claim, to reject it.
And Congresswoman, you referenced the Al-Haramain case in your book. As I mentioned, we've covered that in some detail with the attorney of record in that case, John Eisenberg, and I won't recap it in detail, but one of the critical aspects was that as the plaintiffs in the case, they were frequently outflanked by the government claiming secrets. For example, Eisenberg had to go to the federal building, and in a secret room on a government computer, he composed a response to government briefs in response to their lawsuit. And he wasn't permitted to see the contents of the government briefs. So he had to shoot fish in the dark and say, well, you know, if the government asserted this, my argument would be that. And then he was not permitted to argue his points in response to the government brief. And this, you know, doesn't meet any of the fundamental standards of criminal justice in this country. And again, it doesn't have to compromise secrecy to really litigate the issues of law and the principles under which actions have been taken. Yet, we find that both the Bush and Obama administrations have used sweeping claims that you cannot even touch these cases, cannot bring any aspect of them before a court in public because secrecy would be compromised. And we know that this is a huge exaggeration that really becomes a lie when you examine it closely.
Well, as I said, my experience with classification, both as a member of Congress and as a member of a presidential panel, was that there was huge overclassification. We dealt with the issue when I was in Congress in 1973 of the state secrets privilege, and basically we said, look, courts, it's up to you to be a real check on executive branch desire for secrecy. And we found, I mean, I think that in the last several years, that has not happened. And the courts need to be a bulwark instead of being yesers to the president or the executive branch. Because, I mean, the courts have to understand that not every claim of secrecy is, in fact, a valid claim. You know, that's part of why you have a check and balance. Administration, executive branch wants to expand its powers and keep things secret. But you've got to have a real check against that. Otherwise, we just have more secrecy, more aggrandizement of power, and ultimately what we have is If you can't have accountability because of these secrets, then you have an erosion of democracy.
And Congresswoman, what is available to us if the American justice system is not permitted to work as it's designed, and there is no process moving forward to investigate or hold accountable wrongdoing that occurred during the Bush administration?
You just got to keep going.
But can we look to foreign courts the way Spain?
Well, you can. I mean, I think that I think we can. I think it looks as though Poland is doing something. It looks as bringing an indictment. It looks as though Spain has resurrected an investigation of the lawyers and with regard to torture. I think that that's fine, but to me it's shameful that we can't handle our own problems of democracy here in the United States and other countries have to pick up the cudgels for us. That puts us in a very bad place in the world. We used to be a country that other countries looked up to, not that they have to correct and do better than. I think that that's a very sorry statement for us.
And you also make a passing reference to the case of Abu Omar, who was an Egyptian who was arrested in Milan. He was not an altar boy. He'd been raising money for jihadi groups. But there were 26 Americans who were indicted and most tried in absentia for the wrongdoing, the violation of Italy's sovereignty, and the way they basically just kidnapped this guy off the streets of Milan in broad daylight. And they did it in a Keystone Cops manner, where their cell phones are created the trail of evidence that was used to prosecute them. Not only is it sad to see that the much vaunted American intelligence community operates on such a slipshod basis, but the arrogance of the United States in not permitting any of these individuals to be tried in Italy sends a very clear signal that we believe we are above our own laws.
Well, that's not surprising that we wouldn't do that, but we've not tried to hold them accountable here. And we probably are not going to, because they were probably acting on higher orders. Well, whoever ordered them to do that needs to be held accountable. But that's really the point here. We can't just look. It seems to me that this case or some other case where we're talking about lower-level people is not the most serious problem. The most serious, because you can always have a rogue individual doing something bad or even rogue group of people doing something bad. But when the president or the vice president are acting in violation of U.S. law, something has to be done about them. And that's where the focus needs to be. And as you pointed out, as I reiterated, the fact of the matter is that the facts are not in dispute with regard to at least two of these areas,
right,
where, with regard to torture, where the President of the United States admitted repeatedly that he authorized the waterboarding of detainees and other enhanced interrogation. And with regard to the failure to wiretapping without a court order, he admitted publicly, there's no dispute, that 43 times he authorized wiretapping without seeking a court order. That's a violation of the federal wiretapping statute. Why isn't that being looked at? I mean, if somebody were to stand in the middle of Times Square and admit that he shot somebody, you think nobody would pay attention to that?
Well, I hear your point. Finally, Congresswoman, I certainly agree with you that Bush and Cheney deserve close inspection and follow-up and accountability. But let me ask about two individuals who were pivotal. John Yoo, who wrote the torture documents, torturing the law in the process, and David Addington, who was chief counsel, and then when Libby went to jail, the chief of staff to Vice President Cheney. They were both very active in promoting a lawless agenda and redefining certain statutes in order to pretend that laws were no longer being violated. And I consider them to be individuals who really do deserve accountability.
Oh, I think accountability. We did not look at criminal liability, but certainly accountability, because the whole story hasn't been told of their involvement. We did in the book a very careful analysis of Mr. Yu's memos, and I'll just tell you about one of the torture memos that we took a very close look at. This is a situation in which the president said, as I had mentioned earlier, that really he was allowed to engage in torture because the lawyers told him he could do it. Well, you was picked out. You can't. That's not a defense to a crime, that you go to a lawyer that you know is going to give you an opinion, and the lawyer gives you the opinion that you want so that you can commit the crime. That's not really a defense to a crime. And the only time that is a defense, lawyer's advice, or mostly it's in tax cases where the law is so obscure that most normal human beings can't understand it. So if a lawyer tells you some obscure tax principle is at work, you're entitled to rely on it. But, you know, torture is torture, and you can pretty well understand that. You don't need a lawyer to tell you it's not torture, but that's what they use John Yoo for. And so you created the most amazing memo. This is a man who went to Harvard Law School, who clerked for Clarence Thomas, a Supreme Court judge, and who teaches at a well-thought-of university in California, okay, at law school.
Mm-hmm.
So he knows, for example, that you have to cite, if you're going to say the president has, that Congress can't restrain the president from engaging in torture, you better cite the central case on this subject, which, of course, he didn't do.
Right.
Once you don't cite the central case, it makes all of your thinking and all of your reasoning suspect, not only on that subject, but on everything related to it. But the most amazing part of his memo is where he tries to redefine the torture statute so it doesn't apply to waterboarding, because that's what they were really worried about.
Right.
So first, the definition of torture is creation of severe mental and physical pain, mental or physical pain and suffering. Well, since they thought that waterboarding caused suffering, you said, well, suffering is just a redundant term. It doesn't add anything to pain. It's like love and marriage, death and destruction. They go together. They're not any different. So suffering means the same thing as pain, and we don't have to consider it. So just take that out. Of course, nonsense. Because every word in the statute is presumed to have a special meaning, otherwise you wouldn't put it in there. Okay, the second thing is he tries to define severe pain. Now, you got to really listen to this closely. He said one of the definitions of severe pain is that it has to be physical pain. It has to be the equivalent of the pain of death.
Yeah.
Well, nobody knows what the pain of death is because nobody has come back from the dead to tell us what the pain is, if any.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you would say, well, oh, he must have had something in mind when he wrote that, right? It sounds very serious. So the Office of Professional Responsibility actually asked John Yoo, what was the pain of death? This is in a memo to the president. It has to be the equivalent of the pain of death. Well, John Yoo said, I don't know what the pain of death is. This is a quote in the Justice Department report by the Office of Professional Responsibility. Well, if he doesn't know the meaning of it, how dare he advance that as a ground for defining torture? So the whole memo was an intellectually vapid, dishonest, meretricious exercise simply to give the president an out for torture. And it's just when you read it, you realize how astonishing it is that a man would advance a definition that he doesn't even know what it means. It's really quite amazing. So,
well,
yes.
And it's compounded by the fact that the law school, the Bolt Law School at UC Berkeley, refuses to take any step to hold John Yoo accountable, and they use the guise of academic freedom as the reason to protect him. And as you said, if he'd gone out in Times Square and shot somebody, we'd say, well, you know, John Yoo doesn't enjoy academic freedom. But because he used words and a word processor to twist the law, and your meretricious comment really hits home with me, he's allowed to walk and to continue his job as a tenured professor.
Look, I'm not going down that road. We have other laws to deal with him. We have two things. We have the possibility of a truth commission. We also have the possibility to conspire to engage in torture. We also have a whole issue of missing emails about which he's never been fully questioned. No one's done a full investigation of this. So I think that that's where we have to go. Don't rely on the universities. Let's rely on the main institutions that deal with this kind of misconduct. And that's what we have to do. And that's not happening. But people can make a difference. I mean, people say, well, it'll never happen. I just think about what happened with Pinochet, where after 27 years, he was brought to justice.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't quite get prosecuted, but he got indicted and he got named in proceedings. And all those years when nothing happened, finally the situation turned around in Chile, and he felt the hot breath of justice. And it may well be that these proceedings abroad, Poland, Spain, maybe elsewhere, maybe England, will make the United States people, Americans, understand that we have to do something about our own institutions and clean them up.
The new book is Cheating Justice, How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law and Plotted to Avoid Prosecution and What We Can Do About It. My thanks to Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. She co-authored it with Cynthia L. Cooper. And if it's not too cheeky, Congressman, may I suggest a sequel?
I don't know. I think I've written enough on this subject.
Well, the subtitle would be How Obama and Holder Blocked Investigations and Accountability for Bush and Cheney. I think it's a book that needs to be written, and I hope you'll think about it.
Thanks for the suggestion, and nice to be on your show.
Good to talk with you again, ma'am.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
Hey, thanks for listening. I hope someday we will see accountability for Bush and Cheney, and I pledge to keep working for it. Send me an email, will you?
Happy trails to you.
Try humblehost at peterbcollins.com.
We meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.